Hello, lacrosse friends. Welcome once again to Box the Beat on NLL Radio, also available on iTunes through Inside Lacrosse Podcasts. We are getting down to crunch time. Two games into the best of three National Lacrosse League Cup Championship Series, and it is tied 1-1 after a big win by the Rochester Nighthawks to force Game 3 back in Saskatoon against the Saskatchewan Rush this coming Saturday. And it is an exciting series, very interesting series, because Game 1, Rochester did not look good, and Saskatchewan was dominant. In Game 2, Saskatchewan actually looking a bit flustered and discombobulated, while Rochester had a great game and really took it to the Rush. What will happen in Game 3? Who knows? I am Stephen Stamp. I am the host here at Box the Beat and an editor at ilindoor.com. There's a lot to see on the site right now. We have our year-end awards are all up, and you can go check those out. You can also take a look at the voting of the fans to see what you guys think about the awards. Some of them you agreed with us on. Some of them a little bit of a different take. All very valid and interesting input. And this week, as we prepare for Game 3 of the NLL Cup Finals by looking back on Games 1 and 2, I talk to men who watch all of these games, who see these teams play a ton. They are on different ends of the experience spectrum when it comes to calling games. They are the voices of Nighthawks Nation and Rush Nation, respectively. Craig Grabczynski has done over 300 straight Rochester Nighthawks game as their play-by-play man, home and road, regular season and playoffs. He is there for all of them. The streak almost ended a number of years ago when his son was being born, but his wife, being the good lacrosse wife that she is, managed to schedule the birth for a non-game day. That was fantastic. I do talk with Craig Grabczynski about the Nighthawks and looking back at the three-peat team from 2012 to 14 and how things have gone over the years for the team up and down and the way they are right now as they build to try and get at least one more. And obviously they're looking at multiple championships again. Speaking of multiple championships, the Saskatchewan Rush have won two of the last three. They're in their fourth straight finals and looking to create a bit of a dynasty with three wins in 4 years. I speak to Tanner Fetch, who came on board just this season, partway through the year, as the play-by-play voice for the Saskatchewan Rush. And it is fascinating to look at both of these teams, the Nighthawks and the Rush, from the perspective and through the eyes of their play-by-play announcers, Craig Grabczynski from Rochester, Tanner Fetch from Saskatchewan. I am Stephen Stamp. Thank you, lacrosse friends, for being with me here on Box the Beat on NLL Radio. Enjoy. Joining me on Box the Beat, the voice of the Rochester Nighthawks for more than 300 straight games, Craig Grabczynski. Hey, Ripper, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you have obviously watched this team through thick and thin for a lot of years. What's the count at now? I know you broke the 300 mark earlier in the season of straight games of play-by-play.
I think I'm at about 315 right now, so still going strong here, knock on wood.
Yeah, you can actually go, there is a story in Inside Lacrosse magazine about Ripper's streak that we did when he broke 300. So you've seen this team through the years. You were there, obviously, for the three-peat. And my big question is, when you compare this team to the teams that won those three straight championships, what are some of the key differences? Because this is obviously such a young team that's really rising, whereas that was a team that had kind of been around for a while.
Yeah, the three-peat team, the core of that team was really put together in 2010-11. I think a good comparison might be that 2012 team when we beat Edmonton. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Cody Jamison was in his second year. Sid Smith was in his third year. You know, we had a lot of young players on that team that were just, you know, supposedly just getting their feet wet, combined with guys with like Pat McCready, Micah Kersey. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a good mix of youth and veterans. But I think this year, more than anything else, stands out. 16 players are different from this year compared to the 2014 team. Yeah. We only have 5 players left from the three-peat championship.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a totally new team. A lot of first-round draft picks the last 3 years. We've kind of restocked, and you're right. You know, a lot of people had said we're about a year or two away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after we won on February 11th, you know, we have, lo and behold, you know, gone 11-3, and, you know, mm-hmm. these guys don't accept losing. I mean, there's a kind of a confidence about them that is kind of uncanny. So I think, you know, there's huge differences between the three-peat team in 2014 and this one. And this one's just got a lot of, you know, a lot more enthusiasm. You know, it should be a team that, you know, goes in a little bit nervous. But in fact, you know, a lot of these guys have won at different levels getting to this point. And there's, you know, there's, like I said, just a confidence that you don't really see, you know, out of guys that have only been in the league for a handful of years.
Well, the thing, too, I think it's interesting. You look back and you see a team that won 3 straight championships. And in hindsight or retrospect, you just kind of see that as a dominant team because they won the 3 straight titles. But the big thing is some of the guys even within the team will mention, will point out that, hey, in 2012, the Nighthawks went 7-9 in the regular season, got into the playoffs because of tiebreakers. In 2013, it was an 8-8 team that again got hot in the playoffs. And then the 2014 team, I believe it was 14-4 or so, was a legitimately dominant team throughout the season. Actually, it would have been 12-4 because it wasn't an 18-game season quite yet, right?
That's correct.
Yeah,
that was the team that really kind of said, you know what, we're not going to limp into the playoffs. We need home floor advantage, and they took care of business in the regular season.
Yeah, so in some ways, this team isn't that different to those 2012 and 13 teams in that it is, you know, except that you finished 10-8 this year. But as you mentioned, after the 6-game losing streak, since then, you've been 11-3. And this is a hot team. I mean, I know Saskatchewan was the preseason pick by just about everybody. I picked Saskatchewan before the season to be the best team in the league and to win the Champions Cup. And, of course, it's now the National Lacrosse League Cup. It's hard not to stand by that. But I tell you, I still have to put in my staff pick for IL Indoor for this week, this game. And I just don't know. I will say before game 2, I was talking to some of the folks on the Rochester bench. I think it was Stu Brown, one of the staff, and I said, you know, tonight I think it's going to be a big challenge. I think Saskatchewan wants to finish this up, but I feel like if you guys can win tonight, you've got a really good shot in game 3. And he was like, yeah, you know, the thing is, we're better when our backs are against the wall.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, Matt Vince said the same thing at the post-game press conference. You know, like that's kind of been their mantra all year is that, you know, if they would have lost one or two games down that stretch when they were winning all those games, the 4-game stretch when they played Buffalo and Toronto and Saskatchewan and Georgia,
mm-hmm.
they lose one of those key games, they don't make the playoffs. And they even had to win in the last game of the regular season to secure that number 2 spot.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been really playing, you know, not to use a cliche, but they've been playing playoff lacrosse for a long time now. And this is, I think that adversity has really, you know, kind of prepared them for this type of situation.
It's interesting, you know, when you talk about that, because we saw they had to win down the stretch, but they wind up 10-8, a game behind Georgia, and, you know, 2 games ahead of Toronto and Buffalo, who missed the playoffs. So you think, oh, well, you know, they had a bit of a margin this time. It wasn't like a tiebreaker that got them in. But like you said, that 4-game stretch, if they lose to, I mean, a loss to Saskatchewan in Saskatchewan wouldn't have been quite as devastating because it wasn't head-to-head in the East, but that Georgia, Toronto, Buffalo, you lose any of those games, and it dramatically changed all of the scenarios for Rochester making, and you probably aren't in the playoffs.
Yeah, and obviously it could have, you know, helped one of those other teams, Toronto or Buffalo, get on a hot streak, and, you know, who knows, you may be talking about them right now. You never know. I mean, it's just, we won the games that a lot of people didn't expect us to win. And, you know, after they got rolling, there was really no stopping them.
Now, there are a lot of elements to the success of this team. And I know Matt Vince was named the team MVP. Joe Rezaterets becomes the first U.S.-born player to score 100 points, has an amazing year. Cody Jamison comes back and gets back to very close to his old form. The rookies, the three guys from Ohio State and Fennell, Shanks, and Withers, big impacts. But to me, and I can say this, the defensive player of the year is out now on IL Indoor, and it's Graham Hossack. And because we're recording this, but the MVP story will come out before the podcast is released, I can let you know that I have Graham Hossack second on my MVP ballot, because I think the impact he had on this team was massive in changing the entire culture of the team to just this bit of swagger. And he's not a swaggery guy, but just the way he plays makes everyone feel confident.
Oh, absolutely. When you see a guy that's 6'3", you know, 220 pounds, is, you know, like Cody Jamison said, that's one man throwing down another man, picking him up and throwing him down.
Yeah.
You know, then he goes down the floor and scores a goal. I mean, that's a huge wake-up call for the other team, but it also lets your defenseman know that, hey, that's the kind of level of play that we need to be at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Graham's been that way since, I remember, his first training camp.
Yeah.
Where his fitness level was so far ahead of everybody else. And I think he's a prototypical defenseman, you know, that Kurt, you know, Kurt Stires and Stu Brown and Jody Gage have really looked for, you know, and you see that, you know, kind of glimpses of that in Brad Gillies and, you know, Luke Magnin and some of these younger guys that we've picked up, Wiz, you know, some of these other guys that have, that are, you know, really physical, fast, in your face. You know, and I think Hossack is kind of the leader of that young core of defensemen. And, you know, when the likes of Scott Campbell and Sid Smith are ready to retire, he slides into that role very nicely.
I think it's interesting, not to take away from the credit you give to Kurt Stires and the rest of the staff for finding, you know, for selecting Graham Hossack second overall, but I feel like there were probably eight other teams in the league that after Lyle Thompson went first would have been picking Graham Hossack, because it was pretty clear how good this kid was going to be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was, everyone said, oh, this guy's a can't miss. Wait till you see him play. You know, he's going to be the next Kyle Rubish, or, you know, throw another couple names out, Chris Corbeil.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the beginning, people were skeptical until, you know, he comes out in his first pro game and scores two goals, and, you know, he's scooping up loose balls and just rocking people up and down the turf. I think that's all it took for people to, you know, to buy in and hop on the Graham Hossack train.
The funny thing, though, is he scored. I remember watching that game, his first pro game, and I'd been telling everyone. I mean, I had him as my number one prospect. I was like, when I talked to John Arlotta from Georgia, and I said, you know, you had a great draft. Because they got, I mean, Lyle Thompson and Randy Stotts and Chad Tutton and Jesse King, which is an incredible draft. But I did tell him, I was like, you know, if I had four picks at the top of that draft, you did great, but I would not have left without Graham Hossack, because I think he's that kind of player. But he scored those two goals, and I remember thinking, what the heck is going on? He's not really a goal scorer. They were the only two goals he scored that season.
That's correct, yeah. How to put a lot of pressure on yourself, right?
Yeah. But he scored 7 goals and 7 assists this regular season for a career high in points and goals and assists. And he scored a couple of goals the other night. And the one, the bounce shot, his second goal, which was, I think, your 10th goal of the game, he separates, he just basically blows somebody up at the other end. There's a lot of moving pieces, but he blows somebody up, runs through somebody, fights off a check, grabs the loose ball and is gone. He's too fast for anybody to catch. Goes down and shoots and bounces the ball around 3 feet outside of the crease for a bouncer that went up into the top corner. And that's just not fair. That is an incredibly difficult shot. And I don't even know how he did it. He looked like, I don't know, like I'm trying to think of somebody else who does something like that. And I don't know, maybe Jeff Schattler in his transition heyday.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting because a lot of people said that Graham got lucky.
No,
I come to find out that he actually told Brad Gillies that on his next shift, that's what he was going to do.
No way.
Yes.
Wow.
So he told Brad, if I get another opportunity, I'm going bouncer top cheese, and he goes out and does what Graham Hossack does.
Wow, unbelievable! And I mean, not to not to focus just on him. I'm just a huge fan and want people to recognize just how good this kid is. But, I mean, there's so many contributors. And another one is, you know, Matt Vince was in his prime in the three-peat seasons. He was I thought, a real key to those wins. I know Cody Jamison was an MVP of two of those series, and deservedly so, but without Matt Vince, you're not winning those series, and he won, you know, the five Goalie of the Year awards. And this year, after a couple of seasons where, you know, he struggled a bit with all the changes on the defense, I thought he was incredible all year, and he's been just unbelievable in the playoffs.
Yeah, you know, he plays well in the biggest games of the season. You know, you referred back to the three-peat. I mean, the 2013 and 2014, I don't know if people remember, but he had to make a save in the final seconds in both of those games in order to hold on to a one-goal lead. 3-2 minigame, and then the one-goal win out in Langley when we beat the Washington Stealth. So, is it surprising? Not really, but Matt seems to, whenever you think that he's kind of hit, you know, one level, he seems to, you know, notch it up another level and, you know, do things that you haven't seen before. You know, he's doing kick saves, stopping breakaways. He's, you know, running up the floor, leading transition, you know, a la, you know, someone in the 1970s.
Yeah. So it's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking about it. I was thinking the big thing to me is he makes some of these saves look so easy that are not easy at all. And the one that really stood out for me was, I'm sure it's the same one you're thinking of, the kick save where he threw the left foot out on a shot and got it. And it's hard as a goalie to move your feet as a guy shoots, because you're already having to move in certain directions and plant for things and adjust what the shooter's doing. So to get your foot, your weight onto your right foot, get the left foot out there, make that save, I was blown away by that save.
Yeah, he's almost like an old style of hockey goalie, or when I think back to the days of Dallas Elliott,
yeah,
you know, who used to be a very athletic, you know, making kick saves and, you know, diving and sliding all over the place. That's what Matt really reminds me of.
Yeah. Marty O'Neill, who runs Max Slacks, he makes goalie gear, and he posted some pictures of Dave Evans. And he's told me Dave Evans was a hero of his as a player coming up, and he watched him, and he posted these pictures of Evans playing net, and some of the positions he's in, kicking things around, his arms and his legs flying everywhere. And I mean, Vince is a much more composed, kind of controlled version of that. And with the gear these days, you don't make the same kind of moves, but he makes similar moves, like you said, to Elliott or Evans or, you know, some of these goalies of the past that, and again, it goes back to his conditioning. The guy, you can't tell with all the gear on because they have to be protected, but man, he's in incredible shape. He's a phys ed teacher, and I mean, he's incredible.
Yeah, it's not like the old days when the goalie used to be the biggest guy in your team. Yeah. You know, Pat O'Toole was, you know, arguably one of the best goalies in the history of our franchise, and then, you know, here comes Matt Vince, and Pat gets to, you know, work with kind of the second coming of himself.
Yeah.
And Pat always has, you know, has a great sense of humor, and he said that if he played these days, he would have been cut in tryouts because these guys are so fit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, Matt is a physical specimen. You know, he's kind of what, you know, everyone aspires to be when it comes to fitness. When you see your goalie winning sprint contests and beat tests, and, you know, you're an offensive and defensive player, I think it really drives those guys to be in better shape. When, you know, the guy that's back there facing 40 shots is still, you know, physically superior to you.
Yeah.
You know, I know guys come into camp trying to actually beat Matt Vince in different testing during training camp. So he's definitely set the bar very high when it comes to fitness.
Do they ever do it? Beat him?
You know what? I think Hoslick might have gotten him this year.
Okay.
I know Matt did miss the first part of training, but I think Hoslick got him once, and I think it made him pretty angry.
So, as good as this team is, with, you know, I mean, we haven't even really touched on the how well the ball moves on offense and the team aspect of the defense. I mean, it's working very well, but you guys are underdogs going into game three, I think, largely because before the season, it was pretty obvious Saskatchewan was going to be contender to win the title this year. It was not obvious at all where you guys would be by the end of the season. It was clear that the Nighthawks were improving, but I've talked to, members of the coaching and management staff who have also said, we didn't expect it to be this fast. So you go in as underdogs because Saskatchewan is such a complete team. How do you respond to what they are able to do?
Well, I think that, I think the team has really relished that underdog role. There really weren't high expectations from anyone else except the guys in the locker room, and I think they've held themselves to that standard all year, even when they were 2-6. Obviously, it's going to be a real tough task beating them there on their home turf. They should have a really great crowd. The crowd of almost 12,000 last game was pretty impressive. Pretty deafening, and you can tell that they really feed off of the diehards they have there in Saskatoon. So it will be a challenge, and I think trying to take the crowd out of it, early in the game, like we did when we won there during the regular season, is key. And obviously limiting the runs—that's what really kind of blew up our effort in game one. With a 4-3 lead, and they sting us for 7 in a row. Mm-hmm. Obviously that can't happen, in game number three. So we'll see what happens. I think it's going to be a really exciting game. I think if it's, really a real tight battle, I think that benefits us, being the underdog and being the road team. On the rush, obviously, if they build that 3-4 goal cushion, I know in game one, it was real tough to try to, crack that. And obviously at the end, we just couldn't do it. So. Obviously those are, some of the keys that, that we need to accomplish to come out with a win on Saturday.
Well, I'm not sure if you've helped me make my decision about who I need to predict to win this game. I just think both teams are so good and playing so well. And yet, in game one, I thought you guys didn't look good at all. You looked sloppy or not making passes you normally make, making some decisions you don't. In game two, I thought you came out, the Nighthawks, and played such a smart, poised, composed game. And Saskatchewan looked flustered. And I don't expect – you never expect that from either team at this point of the season in a championship series. So it's really a matter of, I think, of who makes the best decisions in some key situations, a couple big saves here or there. And the other one thing that I really noticed in game two was you guys seem to be working very hard, Rochester, to take away Saskatchewan's transition game, trying to generate some chances yourselves in transition, but also limit them. I actually didn't think Rochester did a great job in the first half. I thought Sask still had quite a few chances on transition, but Matt Vince just shut them down. And then the second half, to me, was more of what you guys are looking to do in terms of controlling the opportunities on transition.
Yeah, that's a huge part of the game, right? They had 5 transition goals in game one. I think we had 1. And then it's kind of like reversing the script in game two where Rochester comes up big in transition and, getting off the floor, obviously you pointed it out. That's a huge, huge thing for our team. It has been, when we've been successful is getting the defensive personnel out on the floor to limit that because, 5-on-5, I think, Rochester has got, one of the best teams in the league. So if we can keep them playing 5-on-5 and not let them generate a lot of transition opportunities, I think we've got a good chance to win.
I'd say one of the top 2 at this point, teams in the league.
50-50.
There you go. Well, enjoy the trip. Have a great call and good luck to the club. I think it's going to be a great game, and I just can't wait till Saturday.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. This could probably go down as one of the best series in a long time.
I might pick a tie. Can I do that?
That'd be interesting.
they just run out of time in the building in overtime, and nobody's, I don't know. I'm still working on it. Thanks so much for coming on. Have a good time.
All right, thanks.
Next on Box Will Beat, I am joined by Tanner Fetch, the play-by-play voice for The Rush. Just want to apologize. The sound quality is generally not too bad, but there is a bit of an echo, and there's one point where it sounds like somebody's saying something. It's just my voice echoing as we talk on the phone to record this show. So apologies for slight lack of quality on the sound, but I think it's a good interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Join me on Boxley Beat, the voice of Rush Nation, Tanner Fetch. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steven. I appreciate it. Big fan.
Hey, it's great to have you on. And I had I spoke with Craig Grabczynski, the play-by-play voice for the Rochester Nighthawks, and you two are kind of polar opposites in terms of where you are in your career. She's done over 300 straight games for the Nighthawks, road and home, playoffs, regular season, everything. And you are in your first season, you're at about game 15 or so, I guess?
Yeah, probably about that point.
Yeah.
It's been a good ride so far. Anyway, jumping in halfway through, getting my feet wet right off the hop. So,
and
it's definitely been a journey.
Yeah, I got to jump in and do color with you at for your first road game in Buffalo, and that was a lot of fun. And I know you've been making big strides since then. You're getting more and more comfortable in the booth.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you were supposed to do that last game with me too, but Ripper took you on his side instead, to the dark side.
Rochester asked me first. So I had to go through with that, but yeah, it would have been, you know, either way, it was a fun game to call, maybe a bit more fun in the Rochester broadcast for that particular game. I know you made the trip, your first time in Rochester, and it wasn't a typical performance from the Saskatchewan Rush.
No, it wasn't. They did start off strong with the first two goals, which I was pretty impressed, and even talking to Cody Jameson after, he kind of thought, oh no, here it goes, right? The floodgates will open, but they really put the brakes on that and hindered Saskatchewan's ability to really make anything happen. They were taking shots they didn't want, and Vince obviously standing on his head, and they weren't getting the power play looks they want either, so they were spending more time in the box than the Nighthawks.
I actually thought, even when it was 2-0, and bearing in mind that Rochester led for a bit in game one, and then Saskatchewan came into control. But I actually thought, even with the, you know, trailing 2-0 in game two, that the Nighthawks looked better than they had in game one in terms of composure and ball, you know, valuing possession of the ball. And I didn't actually think they were in a whole lot of trouble just because they seemed to be playing very smart as well as physical lacrosse.
No, that's exactly it. And I think Jameson put it best when he said Rochester plays the best when they have their backs against the wall, when they're in a dogfight like that. And obviously it showed in game two when they came out flying, right? So.
And it's funny, I mentioned this earlier in the show, that I was talking to Stu Brown before the game. He's on the Nighthawks staff, and he said the exact same thing. We play better when our backs are against the wall. So we don't mind being put in a situation where we're facing a team that's won two of the last three championships, is in their fourth straight championship, and I think generally is considered to be, if not the best, certainly one of the best teams that's ever been put together in the National Lacrosse League.
Oh, for sure. The Rush organization, honestly, I've been a fan since their inception, the inaugural season in Edmonton, and it was a rough go being a Rush fan from the go, right? Because they're trying to build it. They're not like the Vegas Golden Knights, where they're already solid right out of the gate. It took a lot of years of building, and they finally have that organization and that club in that locker room that's brought them to the finals here the past four seasons. So, well, it's been a pleasure to watch and a pleasure to be a fan, right?
Yeah, and there are different ways that you build an expansion team. And I feel like when Edmonton started, they took the approach of, hey, let's get some veterans to lead the way and be kind of the core of this, and then we'll, you know, trying to add some young talent. And I don't know if maybe they went a bit heavy on the veteran side, but it just didn't work out for whatever reason. The team had some moments, but never really got on a roll where they were consistently successful until Derek Keenan took over and started to build things. And in 2012, I think, was where this team turned around, Saskatchewan, because they added Chris Corbeil and Jeff Cornwell in trades with Buffalo. They got Ryan Dilks and Kyle Rubish in the Boston Blazers dispersal draft. Actually, Rubish first. They took him, I think, second overall, and then Dilks they got in the second round of that draft, which was kind of amazing. And then they also drafted, they started drafting guys. Mark Matthews comes in 13. You had Robert Cherokee, out all the offensive guys. But the core of the team was really put together. And Aaron Bold, of course, was a huge part of that, coming in from Rochester in a deal in 2012 as well.
Yeah, Aaron Bold was a big factor. Obviously, all those guys that you named are key contributors and really faces of the franchise, you know what I mean? I was surprised when Bold got dealt, but I like Evan Kirk. He's been good. He's been a solid performer here for the rest of this season and going into playoffs here, getting them all the way into the finals here and going into game three now. I know it was a battle between him and Vince, who play summer ball together, and that was kind of the background story of the media and the news outlets, but right now, let's see, I guess, who comes out on top. I'm hoping it's Kirk, for Kirk's sake and for the Saskatchewan Rush, just because I am a Saskatchewan-born native here, so I'm born and raised here. That's my club, right? So
yeah, I think bringing Evan Kirk in, one of the big factors was that Aaron Bold had a kind of back-to-back really shaky seasons, regular seasons. I think Derek Keenan was pretty open about they weren't getting what they needed from Aaron Bold because of the number five hole goals and short side goals that were going in. The big thing to me that maybe from a fan's perspective could have disguised it was that in 2015 – the team wins and Bold was great that year. In 2016, he actually had a really poor regular season. He was not playing well, never looked comfortable, but he was fantastic in the playoffs as they won the second straight championship and was really playing at the highest level of a goalie can. But then last year, it was a tough regular season and a bit of a tough playoffs, and that may have been the final straw. And I think, honestly, I think the game when New England came in and New England got ahead, or Saskatchewan was ahead late in the game, and Aaron Bold made a save and then took a shot at the empty net at the far end instead of just holding onto the ball, passing it to a defender and killing some time. He took a shot, New England got it back. They scored two late goals and win in overtime, and I think that was the beginning of the end.
Well, that's always a tough decision as a goalie. The smart play is, obviously, like you said, hold it, eat the clock, give it to one of your guys to run up the floor, rag it around, pass it around, whatever you can to waste as much time, right, and not allow the other team to get a look. But sometimes us goalies, I'm a goaltender myself, we get a little greedy and want to try and get ourselves a goal on the score sheet too, because that's a rare occasion, but it's a risky play, high risk, and came back to bite them there, I guess.
Have you ever scored into the empty net?
To be honest, no. So
being honest is good. We appreciate that.
Yeah. So that makes you think a little twice about shooting at it, doesn't it? If you've never scored, then why try now, right?
Exactly. So I do have to just interject that we were both over in Prague for the Alice Robesky Memorial, and we called some games together. We did the Founders Cup together last year, and I've seen you play net. And in Prague, you actually played a little bit of forward. I can't remember, was the e-box beforehand, but you went out and played a bit of forward, and you were shooting. You can shoot.
Well, thanks, Stamper. Yeah, no, that's the one thing about being a goaltender is I spend a lot of time watching and analyzing the game from between the pipes, whether it's watching my defense and the offense come at me or watching my offense work in the other end. You spend a lot of time watching the game, and obviously I'm no slump to, you know, throwing the ball and passing the ball and playing wall ball and stuff like that. So when I got the nod to go play offense for the young Czech team,
right,
I took that opportunity and I capitalized with the behind the back BTV goal, of course. So that's always special.
we should share a link to that on the podcast here, so people could view your that goal, because that was a beauty.
It was a beauty, yeah. The team was in shock. They couldn't believe it. It was on Alberta Warriors, and the Warriors goalie couldn't believe it either. He wasn't expecting it at the time because I was kind of almost by the crease, almost short side, which isn't the greatest opportunity as a lefty down by the crease there to BTB it, but I swiveled the torso, I guess, and pivoted enough to send it towards that short side top corner. So
you know what's funny? I play in a men's league, non-contact league, and it's a lot of fun. I actually scored a BTB goal a couple of years ago. It was not a great shot. I was running down on the crease, cutting across. I'm a righty. I was going across to the right, and just kind of drifted it behind me because I saw the goalie was coming. So I just drifted it, and it just kind of floated in. It was not, but it worked. I scored, and I just thought, hey, that's pretty cool. I got a BTB, and apparently there were guys. Somebody told me later there were guys on the bench being like, did Stamper just score on a BTB? What is happening in the world? It was an unexpected feat. Let's just say that nobody thought I was putting that in.
Well, I guess we each got a BTB under our belts now. Then
there you go. Perfect. There you go. I scored a beauty around the world in Dallas. In like between games at the Dallas Box Tournament last year. The only problem, as somebody pointed out, was there was no goalie at the time. But it was a gorgeous shot. It went in around the world, off one post, the inside of one post, and inside the far post. It was gorgeous.
That's nice.
No goalie, though.
Now that we're talking about firsts and everything like that in Prague, you also threw on the referee jersey, put a whistle in the mouth, and went down putting kids in the box.
I didn't put anyone in the box. I was afraid I'd have to call a penalty. I was pretty glad there were no penalties. I was also glad that I didn't have to wave off any goals for a crease violation. It was close. Bob Hollingsworth, who was doing it with me, he waved one off, and he got booed pretty heartily. But the fans, it was like the 10-year-olds or whatever, who, by the way, are amazing lacrosse players in Prague, in the Czech Republic. The 10-year-olds can play. Like, they run systems. They tend to get on their offsides quite a bit, the lefties and righties. Other than that, it's amazing how well they know that game.
Well, that's exactly it. I think, honestly, in Czech Republic, the development of the game is so far beyond a lot of other places, and they're going to be a threat here on the national stage very, very soon by the looks of it. So, especially if those 10-year-olds keep developing the way they are.
Absolutely.
I know that they get a hand up on the wrong side if that happens, right? At that age, you're still young, you're still learning. Yeah. But, I mean, they're strides beyond where they should be, so.
Yeah. I suppose we should talk about the NLL Cup again, since that's what we're here for. It's just so much fun to talk about some of this other stuff. But the thing, you look at game one, Saskatchewan. What's that? Oh, sorry, I got a bit of an echo on my phone. But Saskatchewan had a great first game. They take the 16-9 win, really dominating. Game two, Rochester really had control from fairly early on through a lot of that game. So it's so up in the air what's going to happen in game three. But as, like you said, you're a Rush fan, you're a Rush announcer, and I would imagine the Rush team as well have to feel pretty confident in the team they've put together. Four straight championship finals, two of them wins so far, and there really aren't a lot of weaknesses on that team.
Well, no, there really isn't. And it's kind of that Tom Brady effect is you've been there so many times in recent years that you know the game, you know what it takes to win the Cup, you built your team around that. You know what you're getting into, right? You know what to expect. Yeah. So, especially when you got home field advantage once again here in Game 3 with Rush Nation, who sells out 15,000 fans every game. Even Matt Vince and the defense on the Rochester Nighthawks say, you know, they've got a little taste of it now playing two games in Saskatchewan here this season and the playoffs combined, mm-hmm. but it's still hard to communicate, and that's such an important thing to play on defense is the communication factor, calling picks, calling rolls, calling the cuts, you know, switches, those kind of things. So,
yeah, that's a great point. It's very difficult.
Definitely something to be wary about or aware about, I guess, is the fact that the sixth or seventh Rush fan, or whatever you want to call it, Rush man, is Rush Nation, and they're vocal. So,
you mentioned the sellouts, the 15,000 plus crowds that are there, but they haven't had the huge crowds in the playoffs. A big part of it is it is harder to sell. I mean, it's not. I like Saskatchewan. I think it's a great province. I think it's beautiful. It's not nearly as flat as people make it out to be. It's pretty rolly and lush. I think it's a nice place, but it is a fairly short summer season, and you've said, hey, when it gets to be summer, people are heading to the lake, and they already have those plans, and it can be a little hard to draw people back in when we're into June here for the finals.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, being in Saskatchewan, like you said, we get 9 months of winter, 8 months of winter. We don't get that long of a summer. so that as soon as the ice is off the lakes or the sun starts shining, people are going to the lakes and they're going to enjoy the sun and the boating and the fishing and that kind of stuff, right? It's a really outdoorsy place once summer hits. And that's why when the NLL season's on in the winter, people spend a lot of time going to the games and finding themselves things to do that involve indoor activities type of thing. But when it's everything on the line, game three, this is the NLL Cup, it's the cherry on top, the season finale, I think they're going to draw a good crowd.
I hope so. I'd love to see 15,000 out there, and I'm looking forward to it. Now, one other factor in this series, one of the greatest players in the history of lacrosse, Dan Dawson, came over from Rochester to Saskatchewan partway through this season, played five games with the Rush, and had 11 points. He didn't play in game one. He'd been a healthy scratch a fair bit. Played game two. Didn't have a great game, but more importantly, the team just, it didn't go as well, and it's not on him. And game two's loss in performance is not on Dan Dawson, but I would imagine you have to go back to Curtis Knight as your righty there, just based on how the two games went.
Yeah, no, I'm with you there, and it's not what I want to say and not what I really want. Like, I think Curtis Knight is going to do unbelievable things, and like you said, game one to game two was night and day, right? So you're going to have to go back to Curtis Knight and go back to what was working. But it's tough to say that when you got Dangerous Dan Dawson. He's an absolute legend and one of the nicest guys, you know, on and off the floor. Unless you get in a tussle with him in an NHL match, then you might not like him. But, I mean, he's a great guy. He's there battling his old team. It means a lot to him, obviously, to take the cup. But he himself says he wants what's best for the team, and he's going to accept whatever role that might be.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, that might be Curtis Knight going in and going back to the Game 1 roster.
Yeah, I mean, Curtis Knight is a tremendous player. It's kind of crazy how deep that team is that you have to scratch one of those guys. But like you said, Dan Dawson, one of the best ambassadors this game has ever seen. And it's funny because you're trying to be professional. You try and look at things impartially, certainly as a commentator, an announcer, a writer covering the game. I try and be as impartial as possible. But I would like to see, if Saskatchewan wins this, I would like to see Dan Dawson on the floor to get the cup. Obviously, he'll come out for the celebration if there is one afterwards. But, boy, it's an interesting story because, like you said, he is about as nice a person as you could have on or off the floor.
Yeah, no, he really is. And I think, regardless, he did get some playoff time. He did, you know, play during the season. And if the Rush hoist the first ever NLL Cup, now that it's a new trophy, it's going to feel just as good as any to hoist it up in front of your old team and take another one home.
And he still has an impact in the dressing room and just being around the team. That's one thing you'll hear from everybody who gets to spend time with him behind the scenes.
Yeah, 100%. He's not getting slough to the wayside by any means or anything like that. He is in the dressing room. He's contributing vocally and with his leadership and his experience, because he's been doing this for a long, long time. And, you know, that experience plays a huge role in that locker room for some of the younger guys and just rubbing off on guys and mentoring some guys in some way, shape, or form. And I'm sure some of these young guys are actually, rubbing off on Dan as well and mentoring him in some way, shape, or form. It's kind of a give-and-take relationship when you're in the locker room with those group of guys. So,
when you look at the performance of the Rush in game two, and you think, well, you know, Rochester scored 13 goals. Maybe the defense wasn't that great, but Rochester scored a bunch of transition goals. I mean, Graham Hossack had a couple. They had some in bench transition and unsettled transition. I counted about six transition goals, including the empty netter at the end of the game. So I think the defense still did a great job, and this really is a defense for the ages. I mean, Kyle Rubish is the clear kind of bellwether because he is the guy who's won four NLL Defender of the Year awards. He's won IL Indoor Defender of the Year awards. He is the state of the art in defense over the last half decade. But, I mean, just going down the list, I mean, Chris Corbeil, Ryan Dilks, who was great in game two, Brett Midsky, it just goes on and on. Jeff Cornwall and Adrian Sorchetti, who's improved so much. You know, they're, and Messenger, the young guy coming in, Matt Hossack, who isn't his brother but is awfully good as well. I mean, it's an amazing group.
No, it really is. And like they say, defense wins championships. And they built an unreal core of defenders. And it's not even the big guys that can beat guys up and be mean, because the Rush can do that. But like you said, that transition, they got speed and they got hands. Like they're putting the ball in the net. And when your transition guys can get a goal before the offense even gets on the floor and really strike before Rochester's defense can get on the floor, you're doing something right. Mm-hmm. Your offense gets a little bit extra rest and you're just striking right away and making Rochester pay for slow transition, slow changes and stuff like that. And you know, that's exactly what the Rush are doing. And, and it's finding success, really, it is.
And it's interesting, I mean, I went through kind of just about everybody, didn't mention Nick Bjelica or Jeremy Thompson.
Yeah.
And then you bring up, you know, the transition, and they'll both sting in transition too. They'll both go back and make some good defensive plays too.
No, 100%. Guys that can defend the ball, and, you know, that role of being a big defender, like, you know, let's back in the day, that goon role, that big, let's say Ty Domi or those kind of guys that play hockey, where you just beat guys up and you didn't have any stick skills, you didn't have any speed, you didn't have a lot of, you know, hands.
Yeah.
Nowadays, that role has kind of transitioned into fast, speedy guys that are still intense and aggressive on defense, but can get those loose ball battles right away and transition that ball up the floor immediately after getting it. It's all about those fast break opportunities and getting it up the floor quickly, right?
Yeah, excellent point. Although I do have to chirp you a little bit that you talked about defenders playing that tough role, and the only guy you gave an example was Ty Domi, who was a right winger.
I know. I used a bad example there. I was scrambling trying to think of big defenders there, and then I pick a small guy, Ty Domi, who's not even a defender, right?
He had a massive head, though.
But just because Ty Domi was a bruiser, he was a good.
He was. He does have a very large head. It's interesting because he actually played for the Peterborough Petes. So when I was growing up in Peterborough, he was he was in town going to school and playing. And I remember you could see, like, he was a good guy too, by the way. Like, we can make fun of him. He's a good guy. And but you'd go down to the mall, the south end of town. And going to the mall, there was a movie theater there. And I remember going there and seeing there's some people going up the escalator. And you're like, hey, there's Ty Domi. You could see him from across the hall because his head was just, it's a big block of a head.
Well, that's probably why he could take so many punches there and then beat guys up there. When you got a big head, there's a lot of cushion there for your brain. So.
maybe. He scored some goals too, you know. He actually did make some plays. Yeah.
He did. I just liked watching him and, well, I'm a big Leafs fan, right? So,
yeah.
Because every Saturday night was hockey night in Canada, and like him, and I like Darcy Tucker's feistiness and that tenacity. That's, I definitely was in Darcy Tucker as an example, just because he was kind of a muck it up guy, get in the corner, get the pucks, and I like guys like that aren't afraid to get dirty for that puck, you know, or that ball in lacrosse. They get dirty for it, they get it, they earn it.
You've set up a great segue to our discussion of the IL Indoor Unsung Hero of the Year and one of the quiet keys to this team for Saskatchewan. I mean, you've got Mark Matthews, who is, I mean, he's an MVP player. Robert Church could be an MVP. I mean, he has had an amazing season. Ben McIntosh with 46 goals. Ryan Keenan, Jeff Shatler, Curtis Knight, so many guys. But Matthew Dinsdale, is such a key to that team. And it's interesting that he was having a tough time in his first few years in the league with Calgary. And then even when he was traded to Edmonton, and I mean, he scored the game-winning goal in that first championship. And still, he was a part-time player because he was finding his way, establishing himself. But now there's virtually no chance that he is not in the lineup for this team because of all the broad contributions he makes.
Oh, no, exactly. When I jumped in halfway through the year, he was one of those guys that every now and then he could turn it on, get 3-4 goals a game type of thing. He was in there getting the loose balls. He's definitely, like you said, IL Indoor unsung hero material. It's unbelievable the strides that he's made. I remember playing alongside him in Coquitlam Junior A for a brief stint there, and they were just, he was amazing to watch then. And now when you find, it's a big different game going from obviously Junior A into the NLL, but he's definitely found his stride and can put the ball in the net, can create spaces. Like, he's doing bunch picks on the left side of the floor there, the right. He's he's bunching two or three defenders up, creating openings underneath for Ben McIntosh and some of those guys there that, you know, I admire. I applaud him for that stuff. Because when you're creating those openings and then when you become a threat that way, then you start cutting to the middle and put the ball in the net, it's unbelievable, honestly. That's why I call him Marty McFly Dinsdale on my broadcast. Not to be cheesy, but I love Back to the Future, and Marty McFly is perfect for it. So.
There you go. And actually, you were there not that long after the inception of the Marty nickname. So for anyone who's wondering why they hear Marty Dinsdale, and it's Matthew, and when you call, he says, hey, it's Matt Dinsdale. So his name's Matthew. He calls himself Matt, but everybody just about calls him Marty because it was it his Pee Wee team, I believe, where there was about four or five Matthews on the team. So their coaches gave them all different nicknames, and somehow Marty just came up and he became Marty Dinsdale. And for anyone who's confused about where that comes from and why they hear that sometimes, that's where it comes from.
Yeah, 100%. When honestly, when I was there in Coquitlam, everyone just called him Marty.
Yeah.
You never even actually really heard Matthew. Even his dad, I think, was calling him Marty, who was the coach of the junior A team at the time. So, obviously, like you said, it just gets stuck. And now I don't even call him Matthew ever.
There you go. You just call him Marty McFly.
Yeah, Marty McFly.
It is slightly cheesy.
Yeah, it's perfect, though. You know, everyone loves the Back to the Future. Those are called classics. So,
yeah.
You got to bring that in there. Especially if he's flying through the air towards the goal.
Exactly. Definitely appreciate you taking the time, and I'm looking forward to the game on Saturday, and probably not nearly as much as you are, though.
Well, no, it's going to be a nice cherry on top, like I said. It's going to be something special. Last year, the finishing bridesmaids is never, and it's what you want for any club or organization, right? It's always tough. There's going to be one winner, one loser. And the Rush are looking to avenge last year's season finale in front of 15,000 fans. And definitely glad to have you there, Snap. I want you to experience what it's like, you know, here in Saskatchewan, how passionate the fans are in Rider Nation and in Rush Nation for their sports. It's honestly a sports hotbed and a sports fan's dream to be here. Honestly, it is.
Yeah, I was.
So you.
Well, I was pretty excited. I actually just found out I'm not going to be coming. I'm not being brought out to do the color for the Nighthawks. So I'm a little bummed, but
yeah, you can experience it through NHL TV nonetheless. But it's not the same as actually coming out here to Saskatchewan. And well, you obviously know because you've been here for Founders and stuff like that. But Rush Nation obviously is a different breed. So. I'm sure one of these days, Stamper, you'll get to come out and I'll get to show you around the barn and you'll get to really take it all in.
Looking forward to it. And for now, thanks for your time today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it, Stamper, and looking forward to the next time we can do this.
All right, lacrosse friends, I'll just about wrap things up for another episode of Box the Beat here on NLL Radio. Again, I'm Steven Stamp, your host and an editor at ilindoor.com. Go there for all the best of Box lacrosse coverage. The NLL season is wrapping up, but there's lots to come in the summer with Senior A, Senior B, Junior A, Junior B, Junior C, lots of American box lacrosse developing, some very exciting things happening south of the border with the IBLA, the Interstate Box Lacrosse Association, and just tons of things going on. I'm going to be traveling all over the place doing play-by-play and covering various things. And, of course, the NLL Combines. We'll go in there with five this year. And then before you know it, we'll be back and ready to go with preparation for the NLL Draft and getting into another season. Of course, in the middle of summer, we have the expansion draft. So there is a ton of things going on. Right now, though, it's all about the NLL Cup Finals. Saturday night is Game 3. A champion will be crowned. Thanks for being with me, and I'll talk to you next week on the final 2018 episode of the NLL version of Box the Beat on NLL Radio.